Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we're going underwater and we'll hear the rumble of volcanoes on the ocean floor and the voices of whales hundreds of miles away, sounds that have never been broadcast on radio before. We'll talk to scientists who are learning incredible things about what's in the ocean, using a secret eavesdropping system the Navy built to track Soviet submarines. Author Tom Horton takes us to Chesapeake Bay in Maryland, where crabbers meditate over an underwater jungle. And the Earth Calendar looks at the unique breeding process of sand sharks. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. About 30 years ago, the United States Navy started building a secret underwater spy network known as the Sound Surveillance System, or SOSUS. The system, which ultimately cost $16 billion, consists of hundreds of microphones placed underwater and connected by thousands of miles of cables. The cables transmit the sound to land stations. For example, the Navy listens to sounds from the entire North Pacific Ocean all the way to the Russian coast at their base in Whidbey Island, not far from Seattle, Washington. The idea is to track Soviet submarines 24 hours a day, wherever they are. About 4 years ago, the Navy proposed to do some tests by tracking loud sounds that it would make underwater. A question then arose about whether these tests would have an impact on whales. At that point, the Navy went to a civilian scientist, Dr. Christopher W. Clark, director of the Bioacoustics Research Program at Cornell University, and gave him access to some of the Atlantic tapes. Much of the sound is at a very high decibel level and at a very low frequency. You'll hear some of it now, played for the first time ever over radio. It's been sped up by a factor of 10 or more, so it's audible to the human ear.
Well, if one had the lung capacity and the right kind of anatomy, and you could dive down to the bottom of the deepest trench in the Atlantic Ocean, if you could dive down to the deepest trench in the Atlantic Ocean, the Puerto Rican Trench, 50, 75 miles north of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, and you placed yourself in this trench, and now think of yourself as a giant, and your ears are spread apart over, say, 100 miles, and you could now hear the moaning and stretching of the Earth's crust, and that would sound much like the rumbling of a summer thunderstorm, constant sort of rumbling and cracking and groaning, almost like bowling balls sometimes rolling over your head. On top of that, there'd be this cacophony of melodies. And if you're lucky, on a good day, you will actually also hear finback whales, which produce very rhythmic sequences of pulses that remind you of drummers or elves tapping at a very regular interval. And then way in the distance, you'll hear the mournful, almost owl-like sounds of blue whales. And you can hear blue whales in the Puerto Rican Trench, and those blue whales will literally be off of Nova Scotia or Newfoundland, that far away. And you'll hear their sounds coming in almost ghost-like. from across the ocean.
Starting in 1933, the Navy began making tapes available to researchers studying undersea volcanic eruptions and whales. Analyzing data from the SOSA system, Steve Hammond manages a program of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is measuring underwater volcanic activity.
We're looking at virtually the entire Pacific. There are places in the Pacific that are shadowed by island arc systems or island systems, but we're looking, so to speak, at virtually the entire Pacific, and we're doing this in real time, and we're doing it continuously.
Hammond says 80% of the volcanic activity on the Earth takes place 1 to 3 miles beneath the surface of the ocean, and during 3 years of his studies, there's been about one major eruption a year. Previously, these had been undetected.
We're finding eruptions in some strange places, but you have to remember that even though this is the largest volcanic system on the planet, until 1993, no one had ever detected and located and studied one of these eruptions while it was active. Even though it's the most common kind of eruption on Earth, no one had been there while it was going on before.
The volcanic activity occurs along geological structures known as seafloor spreading systems, which thread through the oceans like the stitching on a baseball. The effects of these volcanic eruptions are unknown on the surface. But using acoustical data, the researchers for the first time can locate an eruption, reach it by ship, and take samples of the water column above it. In some parts of the ocean floor, there are vents that gush heat and chemicals continuously. These vents are also located by sound.
One way to visualize these is just simply to think about Yellowstone Park being placed on the bottom of the ocean. That's what these hot springs are like, but the water is very much hotter because of the overlying pressure of the ocean. The water not infrequently exceeds 400 degrees centigrade, and it's not boiling.
Hammond tells us that research on the seafloor has led to amazing discoveries of new forms of life in unimaginable quantity.
We've discovered within the past few years that there is actually a very large biosphere that exists beneath the seafloor in the plumbing system, if you will, of these seafloor volcanoes, where the hot water and magmas are circulating in the seafloor. In those areas, there are immense quantities of bacteria that it's estimated now that if you scoop them all out somehow and weighed them, they would actually amount to, that would be a larger mass than all of the living creatures on the continent. So it's a very, very large community of very primitive, very exotic microorganisms.
These microorganisms are beneath the floor in cavities and tunnels and so on, is that correct?
Yes, these microorganisms, these bacteria, are living in the cracks and crevices of the rocks where the hot waters are circulating and where they can have access to the nutrients in these fluids.
And so they presumably function without any form of light at all, is that correct?
Yes, yes. These organisms are chemoautotrophic or organisms. They don't care whether the sun is shining or not. They live using a chemistry that's dependent on nutrients within the hydrothermal fluids. The microbiologists that we are working with tell us that the discovery of this huge ecosystem that lives beneath the seafloor is akin to finding life on another planet. It's akin to discovering a whole new rainforest ecosystem in terms of its potential biotechnical and biochemical applications.
Steve Hammond is the program manager for the NOAA Vents Program, and his research tells us that whoever described the ocean depths as silent had never been there with a hydrophone. When Christopher Clark of Cornell first heard the tapes, thousands of miles of ocean opened up to him at once. Before this technology was available, scientists explored oceans piece by piece. But now they can hear what's going on in spaces the equivalent of Asia, Africa, North America, and Europe all put together. He says when he first heard the tapes, he knew history was being made.
The amazing thing that I discovered when I listened to the tapes were that no matter which tape I pulled off the shelf, and I was randomly pulling them off the shelf, every tape had whales on it. And there were multiple signatures, if you will, indicating different species. And these were signature types that had been very poorly, if at all, described in the scientific literature.
Clark began following one whale sound, which he called Old Blue, and found that it could be tracked over many hundreds of miles. Old Blue was easily distinguishable from other sounds like passing ships and other whales because of its pattern and course. Scientists now easily distinguish between numerous species of whales. Dr. Marilyn Dolheim is with the National Marine Fisheries Service in Seattle, Washington. She says the material from SOSUS is answering many questions scientists have had about whales.
So as you do this seasonal progression of sounds, you can actually determine migration routes of whales and also their habitats that they require. Now the thing that we're real excited about, and we're just launching into that at this point in time, is that what we'd like to do is produce these call density maps for different seasons for different species, and then overlay the physical oceanographic information on top of that. And with that information, we might get more ideas of what these whales' habitat requirements are. And I think that's very, very important for our knowledge about whale distributions and migration and life history parameters.
Whales have lived in the oceans for about 30 million years. In that time, they've evolved to take advantage of the ocean's unique acoustical qualities. Even though whale sounds are incredibly loud, humans can hardly hear them. That's because they're well below sounds that we're used to hearing. But Christopher Clark says that's the perfect place for them.
Sound in the ocean travels extremely far because the ocean is a denser environment than air. Air is very thin. I mean, here we can just wave our arms around in the air without a problem, but if you try waving your arm around the ocean, you feel a lot of resistance. Sound, once it gets into the ocean, can travel extremely great distances, and especially so if the sound is low. And it's not by chance that the voices of blue and fin whales, which are the loudest voices, natural voices, known to humans, that these sounds are selected to occur right at the frequencies which travel the greatest distance in the ocean. So a blue whale that's producing a sound of 185 decibels, and this would be of an intensity of an energy equivalent to a jet engine. I mean, these are very loud sounds. If that sound propagates through the ocean and gets trapped in the deep sound channel, it literally can go from Newfoundland down to Puerto Rico.
One of the problems faced by Clark and Dolheim is the sheer volume of noise. What does it mean? What are the whales saying? And how many whales are out there? Dolheim says they're still trying to get a handle on the avalanche of information, literally gigabytes of data, coming in each day. Although SOSUS has provided answers, it's also revealed many new questions. For instance, whales have been found doing mysterious things in places scientists never expected to find them. Humpbacks have been recorded singing 24 hours a day for days on end. And blue whales have been found between San Francisco and Hawaii in winter, when waters are frigid and turbid. Christopher Clark says these revelations have advanced our knowledge of the ocean by light years.
When you can sit in one place and listen to an entire ocean basin, day after day after day, it's just awe-inspiring. One of the preconceptions, the strongest preconceptions that we've all had, has been dictated by where humans have been able to go in boats. What SOSUS has done has underscored the fact that much, if not most, of the vocal activity and where whales, especially the big whales like blue whales and finback whales, are performing this activity is in the open ocean, it's in the deep ocean.
Clark says that while SOSUS has expanded our view of the oceans, it has also highlighted our lack of understanding. He says we're trying to manage oceans without knowing what's in them or what ramifications we're having. Like so many military programs, SOSUS opened a vast horizon for science. Imagine hearing everything going on in a whole ocean all at once. But the scientific potential has only been partially realized. Until 1993, the Navy filtered out all natural sounds, focusing on ships and submarines. They then discarded the tapes. During the last 3 years, natural scientists say they've gotten more data each week than they could collect previously in a year. But with the Cold War over, the system is being phased out to save huge maintenance costs. It takes $1 million to repair a cable, and they're cut periodically by fishing activities. So the civilians and scientists are in a race against time to collect and analyze all the sounds of the sea before they lose the most extensive eardropping system ever devised. We all have places which are special to us. It could be a city block or a place deep in the wilderness. The oceans and waterways of the earth have always been revered for their beauty, awesome power, and mystery. Tom Horton is the author of An Island Out of Time, a book about the lives and places near Smith Island in the Chesapeake Bay. He presents a portrait of the place crabbers have worked the fertile bay for hundreds of years.
In late summer, the crabber works the shallows that surround Smith Island for miles. He uses his long-handled dip net to shove along, standing in hang-ten surfer style on the bow tip of his little flat-bottom skiff, intent as any stalking heron on the mating crabs, male and female, coupled amid the camouflage of the underwater grasses. The only sounds are the cries of gulls and terns, and the liquid crush and burble of water beneath the skiff's bow, shoved rhythmically to and fro across the flats. Periodically, the netter stabs with barely a ripple, deftly scooping doublers, as the copulating crabs are called. In one fluid motion, he flips each loving pair high in the air, and as they separate, catches the female, who will soon shed her shell and turn soft and marketable. The male is let fall to seek another wife. Mullet and speckled trout swirl the calm surface, and Kano's rays, broad as a man's back, glide alongside the skiff. In the tawny, sunlit shallows, once your gaze becomes attuned, the olive crabs stand out despite their adaptive coloration. The effect of all this, moving beneath your skiff, becomes hypnotic, a meditation. You become absorbed in the minutiae of the underwater jungle and with plucking, in effect, dollar bills from among its fruited groves. And then, to ease your back and shoulders, you look up at the limitless vault of sky and out across the broad Chesapeake, and feel small as a gnat amid this serene grandeur of sky and sea, and there is a peace, a completeness, a connection that seems to run through you from the worm-encrusted tunnels on the shell of an oyster below to the moon that pulls the tides through the oyster's gills. Some days, half the townsmen of the island meet like this, 70 to 100 skiffs strong. Elemental as runes, netter and net are the only verticals in a horizontal universe. As they shove and lean and brace and dip, the crabbers seem to be romancing their slender poles, waltzing with them languidly to the rhythms of tide and the blue crab. And to their every move, the skiff follows like a thing alive. From a distance, the islanders perched on the bows are Chesapeake centaurs, half man, half skiff, silhouetted against the place where bay and sky merge in a luminous silken monochrome, suspended in a dream between mud and heaven, between labor and beauty. It is the prettiest way they know to catch a crab, the islanders say.
Tom Horton is the author of An Island Out of Time. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Today, female tiger sharks are gestating off the U.S. southeastern coast, while their offspring are devouring each other within their mother's body. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports.
Right now, 8 to 12-foot sharks are lurking up and down the east coast of the U.S., foraging for food. Sometimes they even come close to shore, near where people swim. Grant Gilmore is a marine biologist with the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute in Fort Pierce, North Carolina. He studies sand tiger sharks. He says you don't have to worry about these sharks and most others, even though they share the same waters we do.
Right now, and in New York Bight, you will have the males, and you will have the last year's young and maybe some 3 to 4 year old fish, too, trying to get as large as they can and mature, because they need to eat on that very productive ground off of the Mid-Atlantic Bight.
Like many creatures in the oceans, sand tiger sharks have developed strategies to adapt to their environment, which includes a most unusual method for reproducing. Unlike most marine animals, these sharks only produce 2 offspring, or pups, each year. In contrast, blue sharks produce 100 pups. With the blue sharks, many pups die, but at least a few survive. Sand sharks use an alternative method, opting to produce 2 pups, which are about 40 inches at birth, Goliaths of sea infants. Besides their size, they have an additional leg up on their competition because they're well acquainted with hunting.
The embryos actually eat each other in the uterus. When they're developing inside the female, the first embryo to hatch out of the egg actually goes, swims in the uterus and attacks the other egg capsules that contain embryos and consumes those other embryos. Now, all sharks have 2 uteri. They have one on either side. So this means the sand tiger shark will have 2 pups or 2 embryos. The cannibalism is occurring in each uterus at the same time. So if I caught a pregnant sand tiger today, and actually July and August is about the time they go through the cannibalistic phase, we would find embryos developing in both uteri, and then we would see one that has teeth and earlier than the others, and this particular embryo would then be the first one to hatch and the first one to start attacking the other embryos.
Gilmore stresses that sharks of all varieties rarely attack humans, and when they do, it's often by mistake. So for the most part, we're safe. The same can't be said for the sand tiger shark siblings.
Thanks for being with us this week on The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You can write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 341. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, Stephanie Goishman provided additional production support, and Dr. Alan Chartog is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by the David and Lucille Packard Foundation. So long, and join us next week for The Environment Show.